But Dali, I must be the first reincarnation of somebody who's still alive. And anyway, I will talk about an architect who is even more handsome than either James Stirling or myself. I will talk tonight about, and also I will give an extremely undelirious lecture. I will talk about Ivan Leonidov, a constructivist architect who lived from 1902 till 1956. And I will, using Leonidov as a prototype or as an example, try to correct or at least contradict a series of misconceptions that have arisen about modernism and a series of misreadings that have arisen about modernism, basically in an opportunistic attempt, I believe, to fuel the flames of postmodernism. I think for the viability for postmodernism, it's essential that modernism in its pure form is constantly ridiculed and denigrated. And I think that there's an authentic and real, true and present danger that therefore the true purposes and the true achievement and true thrust of modernism will get lost and will disappear in a way beyond any possible recuperation. And basically, I want to, with the work of Leonidov as an example, contradict three major fallacies about the faults or the crimes of modernism. First, I want to contradict the issue, which has been rather belabored, certainly in this place, about the fact that the suggestion that functionalism, the functional part of modernism, was just a rhetorical ploy that in fact hit a mechanistic behavioristic attitude. And I want to show with Leonidov's example that on the contrary, there was a true programmatic imagination at the core of modernism that still has a great potential and a great relevance. Secondly, I want to contradict with the most possible emphasis and insistence that modern architecture wasn't kind of puritanical in its main thrust, but on the contrary, that there is a very strong and unmistakable hedonistic streak latent in almost any modern architectural project, whether it is the constructivist Mies van der Rohe or even such a universally detested figure now as Ludwig Hilbesheimer. The third and maybe again, in this context, most important contradiction that I want to make is that modernism was incapable of reacting to context, or in other words, that it was a-contextual or a-historical. And what I want to discuss and show and display within with the example they need of, is that rather than make a series of explicit literal references or allusions, as the postmodernists around us are busy doing every day, the modernists such as Leonidov developed a much more intelligent and refined vocabulary of analogs and equivalents that in a way could have a dialogue with kind of historical components of a city rather than be a mere simulation of them. How do I switch to this line? So this is basically the program of my lecture. Leonidov was born in 1902. The middle son of 13 children, in other words, the seventh, of a farming family. He was born exactly between Moscow and St. Petersburg. There was a very early charismatic anecdote that clung to him, and that is typical for the generally very charismatic nature of his performance in Moscow. When he was seven, the life of the only cow that the family had was threatened by a hungry bear. Leonidov took a stick and went up to the bear, and by merely looking the bear in his face with a reproachful look, the bear was withdrew himself full of shame. and when we see this look at this relatively understandable. When he was in 1915, in other words, when he was, and this will become a very important thing, especially in retrospect, in 1915 he was sent by his family to become an apprentice icon painter, which obviously is a kind of monumental case of bad timing, to learn this kind of ancient craft 2 years before the Russian Revolution would wipe out, it would make it forever redundant. But we will see that later in his life, this art of icon painting, and with its kind of access, direct access to the most Byzantine Russian traditions, became very important in the later work of Leonidas. In any case, as you know, the before the revolution, and this is again important, Russian art was in an extremely creative state of turmoil, maybe best represented by the work of Malevich, that already by 1909 was completely abstract and unfigurative. And here we have an example of an early Malevich and here we have a second example of a Malevich in 1916 that has become more agitated, and that had for Malevich at the time a certain architectural potential, which he openly discussed. And for Malevich, these forms were depicted relationships between rectangles, squares, and other forms that had, in a way, that were representations of an architectural project that did not yet exist, and of architectural relationships that also did not yet exist. And I have to insist that this kind of painting was produced before the revolution, so that the ferment of constructivism was already really generated long before the revolution started, at least 10 years before. But when the revolution happened, a thing happened in the work of Malevich, namely that the two-dimensional depictions of architectural relationship suddenly became pure architecture, in other words, became literally three-dimensional. And here we have Malevich posing for the first time with a series of what he called architectons that he had generated, and you can see from the paintings above and from this row of enigmatic forms that there is a direct relationship that through the stimulus of the revolution and through with its inherent promise that from at this time the whole visual arts and the whole social contents of society would be drastically redesigned, that through that stimulus the work of Malevich literally took on a three-dimensional aspect. And here we have a kind of catalog of these forms by Malevich, dating from 1921, amazingly similar to later forms that would happen in New York. And what was the peculiarity of Malevich forms and architectons was that they never had a specified program, and nor a specified location, nor a specified site, nor a specified material. We just had very enigmatic descriptions. This one, for instance, was to be made of felt, corrugated iron, tarmac, and painted green, white, gray, and black. And the description of Malevich reads, on some days, the inhabitant of this architectum will step out on his balcony and sit in the sun. In other words, extremely poetic, but otherwise extremely anti-functional architectures. And I believe that in a way, we have to look certainly at the early work of Leonidas as accepting the challenge that is implied in these empty, or at least enigmatic forms, and that it has to be read as an attempt to appropriate these forms and to insert the program in them, or in other words, to make them fit or habitable for some form of human use and for new and maybe mutant forms of human interaction and human intercourse. when he was 20 and 22, Leninov was sent by the village where he came from to be a student at the Vutema School in Moscow, a famous art school that combined all the arts that was a kind of predecessor of the Bauhaus. When he first wanted to study painting, having been an icon painter already, but when he made in 2 years the same leap that Malevich had made from the two-dimensional to the three-dimensional, and became an art as a student, studying mostly with the brothers Vesnin and the architect Ginsburg. And when in 1927, when Leninov was 25, he, so to speak, burst on the architectural scene with his thesis project that really made him a star overnight, and that and which also was the first of a generation of redefinitions of social components and formal components of the revolutionary city of the Soviets. And this project was called the Project for the Lenin Institute. But first, I have to explain something that we'll kind of return later about the condition of Moscow. Moscow is built in the plain of the Moscow Valley. It is dominated by the Kremlin. The Kremlin is a compound of architectural elements that are all extremely incompatible with each other and have a very violent Byzantine quality, extremely exotic. Then the other dominant element is St. Basil's Cathedral, and this whole of this ensemble is surrounded by a horizon of lowish mountains. Now, the communists wanted to make one gesture that would assert drastically that from now on they were in charge of culture, and that would, within a single building, proclaim their statements about the new culture and about the dominant thrust of the new culture. And cleverly enough, they chose the highest point of the mountains so that whatever building was built there, it would literally dominate the skyline and be the tallest building in the city. And on that mountain, they planned a new form of scientific institute that would combine professional science with amateurish science, where the two, where amateurism and professionalism would have for the first time a kind of a fertile interaction with each other, and that would also make the accumulated knowledge of bourgeois society, let's say, accessible for the first time for the proletariat of the city. Now, Leninov's thesis project, as I said, was dealt with this, and it's, we have to imagine that it can on this hill. And we found an early version of the Lenin Institute, which immediately makes clear his debt to Malevich and the extent to which his work is related to the aesthetics of Malevich, but differing only in this kind of major and categorical degree that it has an extremely explicit program. So what Malevich, what Leninov had here is an enormous volume of books, and slotted underneath it a series of reading rooms where the books could be digested. But and what was always kind of from the first moment onwards a very extremely important component of the project was that the silver capsule would be suspended from a cable and maintain a connection between the new project and the old center of the city. And that connection is indicative of the fact that, that modern architecture literally was capable of making connections. But there is another form of connection here. The Kremlin is known for the abundance of its golden, or rather gilded, domes. And Leninov's first project was marked on this hill by two enormous golden balloons that were constantly moving in the wind, and that were from the beginning extremely explicit reference to the past, to the historical forms of the Kremlin. Here we see the, just the shadow of the balloons and the cables that keep them from going off, and here we have the kind of balloons seen from above. So what we have immediately is kind of a statement by modernism that somehow the balloons that in the Kremlin are still very solid and concrete have acquired a kind of dematerialization, are not heavy anymore, and kind of are now floating in the wind. It is necessary to understand any part of Soviet architecture that all Soviet architects and as all Soviet citizens expected the imminent breakthrough of scientific breakthrough of two issues. First, they expected that death would be definitively conquered in the early part of the 20th century, in the 20s. And the second breakthrough they were counting on was the conquest of gravity, literally. They knew that kind of within 5 years, Soviet scientists would be able to suspend gravity for any given volume so that it might flow. And we have to look at this architecture as a kind of anticipation of that point, because it was built on dark green pilotis that were invisible on the from the ground, so that if you stood in the center of Moscow, it seemed as if these two volumes were floating, just hovering above the hilltop, almost lifted up by the gilded balloons. Another view with two more shadows. Now, the definitive project, which is the well-known one, we can see exactly what changes were made. The first one, and most important, is that the Bug reservoir, which used to be horizontal, has been lifted and erected and become a vertical tower. And this is, again, to deny the alleged inability of modern architecture to produce metaphors. This is obviously a metaphor, just as water towers are always placed on the highest point of a city to create the pressure of water throughout the city's territory. So this knowledge tower is also placed on the highest point of the city to create a pressure of knowledge on the whole city. The cable car is still there. It stops at the reading room, which is at the same kind of station. This is an area where the planification of culture for the whole Soviet Union is planned. And here is a series of scientific research established. But obviously the major change is the fact that the two balloons have fused and become literally one glass auditorium. That rests on a very slender steel structure. In this auditorium for 4,000 people, it would be possible for the new Soviet citizens to be confronted with the latest discoveries of Soviet scientists. But again, we have to also realize, and I said, especially if we see that the early project had two balloons, that this is also a metaphor of a balloon, and that these cables that are at the same time at once a very economical way of supporting the balloon have also a metaphorical purpose, namely to suggest that if they weren't there, this globe would start to levitate and maybe to take off and become something of a planet. So again, the strong anticipation of imminent takeoff. So here we have the plan, the reading room, the planification organization, and here the scientists. This is also based on a system where Soviet scientists would work, and then extremely naive members of the population would wander into the laboratories and ask like holy fools questions that in their stupidity were triggered extremely brilliant insight. Here we have the kind of the thing implanted on the hills, as I said, over Moscow, but here the river, and then the cable car. Here a section to the balloon or to the auditorium. And maybe the most staggering or stunning part of the whole scheme was this tiny sphere, which was a projector that would project ideological messages on the clouds over Moscow. But that would also emit stroboscopic flashes at night, so that if you stood again in the center of Moscow, there was the real moon, and then flickering in totally irregular and unpredictable rhythms, there would be this moon of the auditorium and the inexplicable slab of the town. So creating a kind of dialectic between the stability of the city and the instability and unreality, in a sense, of the new modern component. So there we have the kind of thing going on. Okay, so this is Leonidio for the first time, and what I want to stress is that in a project like this are combined extreme programmatic imagination, extreme formal sophistication, and extreme metaphorical capabilities. So after the, kind of the first cultural episode, Leonidio then, in a series of works, really addresses every major component of a given, and in this case, Soviet society. And the second part which he takes is the office building, and through the office building he deals with the whole issue of work. This one dates from 28. It is, for the first time, whether you like it or not, appears the slab in architectural history. It is modified in the sense that the two-thirds, a complete floor is left out and replaced by a part. The same is true of the roof. A separate pavilion with a separate elevator takes the random inhabitants of the city of Moscow directly to the roof, where they can use it as a viewing platform. There are some gestures toward social organization here, in the sense that this whole podium contains communal facilities such as sports and gymnasia, reading rooms, etc., for the workers. The elevation is, and I think that here there, we have a first and very explicit manifestation of this bonding of rigor and hedonism, which I think is, rather than be kind of incidental in modern architecture, is its essence. A very direct steel and brutal steel grid in which window panes could be kind of removed and completely disappear, and where in summer the entire grid became a kind of tropical jungle that was arranged on vertical planes. Here we have the side of this. But what really made the this building revolutionary in my eyes is the Leonidio's redefinition on each floor of the whole sequence and the whole type of everyday work. Because two-thirds of the building are given over to are gridded and in smaller kind of compartments. Each compartment is a table and a chair, so that so far regular kind of office accommodation. But then there is a kind of marginal or antithetical zone where completely opposite and hedonistic activities take place to counteract the kind of fatigue that might arise in this work zone. So there's a swimming pool, a sauna, a shower, a reading room, an acoustic console, and an area where one could watch television, and some lounge chairs where, for those who want to, one could do absolutely nothing. And it was Leonidio's theory that one could give any, one could indulge in any given activity only for 10 minutes, and then fatigue would start to erode performance. And the solution to that was that what he proposes in this floor, simple as it is a drastic reversal of the normal way in which it worked, in the sense that what he proposes is an endless series of peak activities, namely one would work for 10 minutes at peak capacity, then swim for 10 minutes at peak capacity, then work again, then read again, then work again, then listen, then do nothing again. So rather than become exhausted and battered by a single activity, through a relentless alternation between activities, one could always erase the type of fatigue left by the previous one and be continuously and relentlessly at one's peak. And that through architecture and through an architecture that, as I'm afraid many people would now think, was very boring. In other words, I want to insist that such architecture is not boring once one looks at its kind of programmatic potential and programmatic activities. Now, here there's the same project can be represented. but in an extremely abstract form that also relates to Leonidas directly to Malevich. And here is also the root cause of a certain resentment that Leonidas started to generate extremely soon in his career, because what this represents, the big rectangle is the podium of social facilities for the workers, with the running track. This gridded area is the lobby with a walkway to another street, and this circle is just an abstract representation of a landing place where implausible or unusual, unexpected events could take place. So basically, he composes those forms and again describes in this stretch of event scenario. But of course, traditional architects, and even in Russia, there were many. Resented this kind of frivolity. Anyway, in 1929, Leonidov produced a third project, which is called A Palace of Culture, in which, even more than in the Lenin Institute, he really addresses the whole issue of what culture ought to be and how it ought to be embedded in the city. And because the whole city of Moscow was so enormous that, and the, basically the potential of the Soviet state to change the city is so minimal or negligible, that a new tactics had to be devised to somehow emancipate or rehabilitate the whole area without really restructuring it or destroying it. And but the metaphor Leonidov chooses is almost like acupuncture, or maybe of considering the whole urban realm like a pond and throwing at strategic locations stones in the pond so that every part of it would be involved in some of its ripples of the stone. So here we have this kind of diagram where each point in the city would be within the reach of at least several of the cultural ripples emanating the message of the revolution. And then he was a man of very few words. He wrote no more than 100 words in his lifetime, but at least as far as we could retrieve him. But here, in a very eloquent manifesto, describes the kind of culture against and is for. If you have an actor aiming a toy gun at the camera, and that is crossed out with the second violence because it's stale histrionics and a stupid tradition. In place of that, there would be Leonidov propagates the aesthetics of the always impermanent aesthetics of a cluster of motor drivers or health angels that form unpredictable patterns on the face of the earth. Or, again, the beauty of a tract of land worked on by a sensitive tractor driver. It doesn't go forward anymore. The sign of the time. Here we have kind of further actions, further things he is against. He is against the traditional theater, against even the consecutive club, against, of course, easel painting, and for the beauty of the exploration of the earth as an abstract work of art with airplanes or zeppelins, is against the gratuitous engineering of a high heel and for the beauty of healthy women jumping at random. And here is here is maybe the most telling and important and maybe the ultimate Leonidov statement or the ultimate representation of Leonidov architecture. A man suspended on a balloon that just lifts his weight so that he would jump and be lifted by the balloon and taken by the wind at an unknowable destination. And that kind of leap into the unknown and leap into adventure and leap into impermanence is again an essence of modernism that is now ridiculously... willpower doesn't help me. Anyway, so this is the visual statement for the contents of what culture ought to be, and then Leonidov applies it in what he calls the Palace of Culture, which was, interestingly enough, to be built on the site of an old monastery. Now, the monastery, just like the Kremlin, is in a way what the bloc is in America, the monastery is in Soviet urbanism. It is the kind of the basic unit of urban urbanism. And what it consists of is of an area that is simply demarcated by a wall, and within which can reign a complete anarchy of architectural elements that are violently at war with each other. And that in itself is kind of responsible for some of the exotic and flamboyant quality of Russian architecture, this lack of coherence, or rather the kind of trust that the single act of holding a space will give it coherence, if not visual, at least literal. Now, on this site of this monastery, they never built this scheme, which is very simple. He takes the walls down and replaces them with a grid of white lines, just as the white lines on a football field also define a charmed territory and imply a series of rules, and in a way, even without any players, say something about the game. In the same way, he defines the area by simply the act of drawing white lines on the ground, and then dividing the rectangle in four sectors, one for physical culture, one for mass culture, one for theatrical culture, and one for scientific culture. The elevation is flipped compared to the plan. So this pyramid is here, these spheres are there, and this scientific institute is here. Now I will kind of go through them one by one. This is the sector for physical culture. It is a series of athletic fields, and at the center there is a pyramid. There we see the kind of, and in this part, maybe most obviously, we see the virtuosity of Leonidov to deal in every case simultaneously with the functional, the formal, and the metaphorical. Because, of course, the pyramid is usually a symbol of death. But that meaning is completely subverted through the use which Leonidov makes of it. First, the pyramid has two faces that are steel and glass, in other words, mineral, and two other faces that are covered with vegetation. So it's kind of a hybrid of ancient and modernity. Here we see the kind of vegetal side and the modern side. Now, the basic metaphor of the pyramid and the way he kind of undermines its meaning, kind of kills its meanings of death, is by creating an oasis within the pyramid. There's an artificial sun kind of suspended in the top, and then this area is a sand. And then, as everybody who's ever had the temerity to have a pyramid in his buildings knows, there is a terrible area just near the ground, where the slopes hit the ground, which is unusable for any human purpose because of the lack of headway. And then again, Leonidov solves in a perfectly functional, rational manner by proposing on exactly that location a swimming pool. Because nobody can, because every swimmer needs literally only the room of a bobbing head on the waves. But at the same time, of course, the fact of putting a pool here makes this whole thing an island, makes the area with it on the island in a kind of beach. And here we see the division of the beach with sports, other activities, and then hedonistic activities juxtaposed. And then the users would kind of enter, get dressed, and enjoy this beach or this oasis within the pyramid. That, as I said, combines and bonds all the possible issues that are usually discussed separately. The theater was also completely redefined, in the sense that there was no traditional proscenium. On the contrary, there were seats and sectors, and in the middle of the theater, an enormous gaping hole, a kind of navel, and through the navel would appear satellites, so to speak, which had kind of fragments of decor or sets, and on which were inhabited by actors. So sometimes kind of one was kind of just watching the whole, like a flying saucer, a satellite would swoop out with an actor or two actors on it, and then after that another satellite would follow. And the theater became the kind of the dialogue or the between the planets, so that sometimes one actor would yell at an actor on another planet, and sometimes they would kind of collide. One actor would leap from one planet to another. And in the ideal form, according to Leonidov, the planets wouldn't even be manned by actors. That was a kind of compromise towards old-fashioned histrionics. But the planets would really become a planetarium and present a spectacle of the poetic movement of heavenly bodies that in this case could also be controlled by the audience itself. And then again, the scientific institute that works as in the earlier department. Now, the reality of Moscow is the following. It is an extremely low-rise city that has very few major buildings, and even in the center is still for 20% occupied by wooden structures, so and which makes utterly a kind of metropolitan structure. Now, in the 20s, the modern architects were divided in two camps. First, the urbanists, whose ideology it was to, in a way, intensify the city and redeem the city by imposing on it certain model or prototypical structures of a kind of new scale in which that could be representative of new urban life. So they wanted to save the city by these kind of injections of new urban life. The other group opted, were called the disurbanists, who wanted to do away completely with any concept of the city, any recognizable concept of the city, and wanted to disperse the whole population of the city in a kind of endless suburban strips of one rooms from on legs that were wriggling through the landscape and connected by a highway. And here we see one of the proposals of the disurbanists for Moscow, where really the whole city is obliterated and replaced by these suburban belts within nature. Now, we have the first project of Leonidov that deals with the issue of habitation and the issue of city very neatly, and I think typically kind of short-circuits this whole dilemma between disurbanists or urbanists, because what he does simply is to combine the best of both and to cut much of the landscape somewhere in the Ural Mountains at the ironworks of Magnitogorsk to basically create a very thin metropolitan strip that runs through the virgin territory of the Ural Mountains. So he doesn't disperse the people, he doesn't concentrate on the cities, but he concentrates in a metropolitan belt that has still always at all times a direct relationship with nature. So here are the works, and here is the strip that moves for 25 kilometers, 80 miles, through very agitated terrain of the barren Ural Mountains. And here we have the kind of first reading of it. The strip is again subdivided in squares, and we have to kind of realize that the architecture of Leonidov is so simple that in a way it is nothing but a subdivision of territory, and where he stops when the sites that he has gotten through subdivision coincide with the areas that he needs. But I mean, it is simple, but at the same time, magic. Anyway, the middle of these strips is for habitation. Here are social facilities. Then they're connected by a highway, and those elements or components that don't fit within this framework, like universities, kind of farms, would be at regular distances as kind of absolute forms, and monuments give different character to parts of the strip. This is this image is an early version where everybody is accommodated in low-rise elements, but later Leonidov in the second version where one can choose to either live in one of these 8 high-rise blocks, or where 4 low-rise blocks, or where 4 low-rise blocks are stacked together to form a single high-rise tower. So the strip catered for both preferences, and then here the source facility. Here the accelerator of the whole scheme. And I want to kind of discuss just the basic component of housing and one of the... Here we have the basic component of housing. It consisted of a cruciform void, two stories high, a double-height cruciform void, where the kind of arms of the cross each time were equipped for different kinds of social activity. There was a breakfast room, a sports room, a reading room, etc. And then each time, 2 rooms were put in the corner, and we're given a total of 8. And then there are staircases going to 8 more rooms in the corner there. So there will be a total of 16 rooms sharing one of those communal spaces. Here, we have a kind of view, the perspective in the void. Here, the athletic implements, the lounge, the separate rooms, and here, an elevation to which you would witness nature at all times. And here, we have a second kind of infuriating example of Leonidas, both almost defiant economy of means, where he really gives all the basic information of this scheme within a single drawing. Because here we have the ground plan of the major unit. Here we have the plan of the second floor. Here we have an enlarged version of 2 of the rooms. Here we have the elevation of the inside. And here we have the elevation of the outside of the house. And here we have the isometric. So basically, all the information of a single urbanistic scheme is condensed and compressed in this one element. And here the 4 lowers are stacked on one tower. And the fact was that the whole presentation of the scheme was done in 24 hours with chalk on blackboard. And that kind of accounts both for its economy and its kind of almost frenzied aspect of haste. But still, within those 24 hours, there was time to consider every component separately. In this case, a little sports pavilion that sets up, I think, an extremely rewarding and dramatic tension between the sexes. Because this is the ground floor, basically the locker room, but the lockers fail to separate the rooms completely, so that men and women have addressed, but still there was this provocative gap between the kind of separation. Here, shower, and then the kind of tension that was built up by this very simple arrangement was released or exacerbated by a climb of the 2 sexes on this ramp, and then could be immediately sublimated on the second floor, which was the sports room, where all this energy could be channeled in athletic activity. So even the kind of simplest, smallest component of a scheme like this has a very strong and potent scenario and a strong story to tell. And of course, and I don't want to belabor the point, is far from hedonistic, ruthless, and any of the other accusations against modernity that now leveled at it from all sides, even the most respected. Here we see this door kind of, here the haste is really almost tangible, where all the kind of perspective lines have a different vanishing point. Anyway, we have now reached the 29, the 30s, and as we all know, the constructivist episode came to an end through the increasingly ruthless assertion of Stalinism, of its kind of intentions, and of its control. And that was a control that first was apparent in other fields, but that finally was also asserted in architecture. And here we have the kind of looming in the background of this building, which is the kind of building we always discuss, the spectrum of Stalinism. And I think in this picture, it is even more graphically evident, because this is a panorama of Moscow, where the Stalinism kind of overwhelms and dominates in an unbelievable degree. And the building we just saw is here, the famous Ginzburg building. So it is a peculiar aberration of